Hey everyone, my guest today is Dr. Steve Austad, who is a professor in the healthy aging research of the Department of Biology at the University of Alabama. He entered the field of science and aging research after training lions, which is a whole other funny story in itself. But Dr. Austad has a unique perspective on aging research. He thinks we should be studying more long-lived species like bowhead whales and different types of birds and bats to understand better why they live so long. We also spoke about the data on caloric restriction and fasting on longevity. And finally, we spoke about different essays from his book, To Err Is Human, including Will Coffee Shorten Your Life?, The Blue Zone Myth, and The Effects of Young Blood for Longevity. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Dr. Austad, and welcome to the Live Longer World podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm very excited to talk to you, not just because of your research in aging and your unique perspective on looking at longer lived animals, but I think you also have a very unique backstory on how you got into aging research. So I'd love to start there, and I'm sure you get asked the story multiple times, but it's hilarious and mind-blowing.
Sure. Well, I mean, there are two backstories, really. There's one about how I got into science, and there's one about how I got into aging research. Aging research really started I was in South America. I was in Venezuela working on some birds there. Wasn't interested in longevity at all. And a friend of mine was trying to study foxes, but he was having no luck because he kept getting his traps filled up with opossums. Now, these are very similar opossums to the ones that occur in the U.S. They're not the same species, but most people would not be able to tell them apart. So I said to him, you idiot, you're working on the wrong project. You should be studying these opossums. And he said, well, what can we do with them that would be interesting? And we came up with a project, had nothing to do with aging, but part of that project meant that I had to go out and I had to capture them every month. Hmm. And I had radio collars on them. And if they died, I could tell that they had died because I had a switch on the radio collar that would change its frequency when they stopped moving. And what I discovered by accident is that they aged incredibly fast. I would catch one that was a vigorous young adult, and I would catch it 2 or 3 months later, and it would have cataracts, and its muscles would have shrunk, and it would have parasites, and just be a mess. And that observation attracted my attention far more than the project that I was actually working on. So that by the time I finally published the project I was working on, I lost interest in it entirely, and I was interested now in why they're aging so quickly. And because I'd assumed that they would age kind of like a house cat because of the size of a house cat, but they didn't. They age so much more quickly. And that observation has kept me interested now for over 30 years in trying to understand why different animals age at different rates. And is there any lesson that we can learn from them about making us age at a slower rate, possibly?
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I want to dive into. But maybe backstory even before that, how did you get into science? And that involves some lions being driven in her.
So I was an English major as an undergraduate. So I wasn't at all interested in science. The only science course I took was, we called it microbiology for poets. And the closest we got to a laboratory is that the professor wore a laboratory coat when he was lecturing for some reason. But anyway, I did a variety of odd jobs while I was writing The Great American Novel. And since you've never heard of The Great American Novel that I wrote, you can see how well that went. But eventually I found a job by accident training lions for the movie business. And I didn't know anything about them when I got into it. It was a sheer accident. I got hired. I told the movie producer, I don't know anything about lions. He said, that's okay. I've hired people who you can learn from. And so I did that for 3.5 years. And it awakened my interest in what made animals tick. You know, I most of the time I was spent trying to keep the animals from killing me. That was one kind of thing, way that animals tick that I was interested in. And that really awakened my interest in biology. So when I decided I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life, because believe me, the Hollywood crowd is a really boring crowd to be around. You know, they may be celebrities, but by and large, they're not very interesting people. So when I decided I didn't want to do this for the rest of my life, I thought, I'll go back to school. I'll learn a little bit of science and try to study animal behavior in a more systematic and rigorous sense. And that's what I did. In fact, I went to graduate school with the aim of studying lion behavior in the wild. And early on in my graduate career, I went over to East Africa, to the Serengeti, where a lion project had just wrapped up, and thinking I might take it over. But in the interim, between the time I heard about it and the time I got there, someone else had already taken it over. So that didn't work out. I came back and switched to something very, very different. I was actually interested in how animal combat behavior evolves, because I'd broken up a lot of animal lion fights, so I knew a lot about animal combat. And that's what I did my PhD on. So it was really animal behavior that I was interested in, but then I got exposed to aging, and that just struck me. I think because everything else I did, as soon as I felt like I kind of had it figured it out, I had no interest in it. And aging, I don't think I've ever quite figured out. So it's maintained my interest.
Yeah, I think you see that a lot with people who are attracted to the aging field. Sometimes they just get bored of all the easy things, and then they want to move on to the ambitious things. And aging is, I mean, there's just so much yet to be figured out that there's so much you can keep learning and keep discovering, which is fascinating.
Right, which is fun, right? Because you can get, suddenly you're interested in the immune system. So you have to learn all about the immune system. It's great. It really is.
Yeah. Okay. So then you started doing field work then, and obviously your background was also just studying animals, and that's how you got interested in studying long-lived animals, the story you told us about opossums. Maybe tell us about like what you've learned studying some of these long-lived animals, maybe some examples or just, different animal species.
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned, and I don't think we knew this a while ago, is that there are many ways to be long-lived. There's not just one magic thing that all long-lived animals share. Some of them, it's because they can maintain their cellular energy balance. Sometimes it's that they are better at maintaining their protein. Sometimes it's just because they live a very, very slow life. I mean, this is, and you know, that's probably not the kind of long life that humans are interested in. You know, I've been thinking a lot recently about giant tortoises. And, you know, giant tortoises can live over 150 years for sure, maybe as long as 190 years or so. But they do that by living extremely slow lives. Their heart beats at 6 beats a minute. You know, when they're sprinting, they're covering about 200 meters a day, you know, if they go 24 hours a day. So that's a long life, but it's probably not the kind of long life that most people envision for themselves.
I also feel like wouldn't it have the opposite effect on humans? I mean, if we're just living such slow, sad, I guess there's one aspect of you're living a completely stress-free life, but then the other aspect is, I mean, if you're not moving at all, you're not exercising, we kind of know that's not good for us.
Right, right. And I mean, the world would seem to move so slowly, right? I can't imagine. So if we could, for instance, go into some sort of suspended animation and live 1,000 years because we were locked up, frozen in a box, that's a long life, but I don't think it's the kind of long life that people care about, right? We want to be active and vigorous and healthy for a long time. So what that's taught me is that there are really animals that live a long time that are less interesting, and animals that live a long time that are more interesting, and more interesting because the way they do it might seem more applicable to the kind of longer, healthier life that humans aspire to.
So can you talk about some of those animals, the more interesting ones that?
Let me just compare two that are that live a very, very long time, but in a different way. So there is a whale species called the bowhead whale that is estimated to live over 200 years. Now, you might think, well, that's a very, very different. It's the whale that lives in the coldest water anywhere. In fact, they protect themselves from predators by going under the ice where they can still break through, and their predators like killer whales cannot do that. So it's a way to escape. But here's the interesting thing about them. Unlike cold-blooded animals like the giant tortoise, the colder it is, the slower everything moves. With mammals, it's the opposite. The colder you get, the more your metabolism kicks up. And we now know that bowhead whales have about three times the metabolism that we previously thought they did. So they're not a slow animal at all. They're a fast living animal, but they live 200 years. So how do they do that? We don't know a lot about that yet. It's early days. And in fact, I think I've been thinking about them a lot. I've written a book just recently that's going to come out in a couple of months where I talk about this. I think they're underestimated. I think they live longer than people think, maybe as long as 300 years. And the reason I say that is that the way we've estimated their longevity is by a certain biochemical reaction that goes on in their eyelids. And that biochemical action, though, depends on the temperature. It goes slower at low temperatures and higher. Well, to calculate the age, they had to estimate, well, what temperature does that eye, live at for, decade after decade? And they assumed it was a standard mammal body temperature, 37 degrees, kind of like ours. But if you think about it, this eye is just a few centimeters from ice cold water for, decade after decade. So I think they way overestimated how fast this was changing. And so I think if you assume that it's changing slower, that means they're living longer than we thought. So I think they're really interesting. Now, it's hard to bring them into the laboratory. Probably never going to have a laboratory full of bowhead whales. But still, there's a lot of stuff I think we can find by studying their cells, by learning how to turn their skin cells, which are not that hard to get, into heart cells or brain cells. We have ways of doing that these days with induced pluripotent stem cells. So I think that's a particularly interesting animal. Another animal that I think is interesting, and this is where my love of the common place comes in, because I really think that part of my career has been pointing out what everybody knows, but nobody sees, nobody observes. So I think one of the more interesting animals is something called a house sparrow. Now, house sparrow is a little dicky bird that is everywhere in the world. It's the most common bird in the world. In the wild, though, it can live up to 20 years, and a mouse lives up to a year, maybe. So it lives 20 times longer than a mouse. It has twice the metabolic rate of a mouse. It has a higher body temperature, so all these chemical reactions should be running faster in it. It has levels of blood sugar that would make it diabetic if it were a human, but yet it lives 20 years. So everything about it suggests it would be really short-lived, but yet it lives 20 years. How does it do that? So here you have a very common animal, an animal that you can bring into the lab that you can study, that I think is way overdue to have some serious study done of it.
So what do we know so far? Has anyone done any studies in house sparrows?
No, they've been entirely ignored. And I think it's because they're so common. People think that if it's common, it must be lack interest, I guess. So I'm hoping to get some interest in this species, because I think we could learn a tremendous amount from understanding how it resists all these things that we think should be causing it to fall apart in a hurry.
I think that's a great point, because most people I've spoken to, or the other scientists in the field, basically doing research on fruit flies or worms or mice. And there are all these different animal species that, as you said, we can learn from. And I, yeah, that is a good point. That is probably underrated.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, this is kind of my pet peeve, is that we're 95% of our research effort goes into trying to understand animals that are terribly unsuccessful at aging, thinking that if we can find ways to make them slightly less unsuccessful, it's somehow going to turn into therapies that are going to help humans, who are already one of the most successful mammals at aging in the world. And that logic just kind of befuddles me, but yet that's where 95% of all aging research is. And I understand it. You can do very neat work with these animals, right? They're genetically tractable. I mean, you can do crazy neat biology with them. But is it going to get you where you want to go? I'm a little bit dubious about that.
Yeah, that's funny. I think you've hit upon a blind spot, because, I mean, almost every other industry looks at the success stories, right? And then you study that. I mean, you can learn a lot from, like, the quote-unquote failures. And here it's, like, not exactly a failure, but actually understanding the genetic biology, as you mentioned. But, yeah, maybe there's, like, just so much we're missing because of not studying these success animals.
Yeah, I mean, what can we do? We can turn off a gene. We can soup up a gene expression. And, yeah, if we do one or the other, they live longer. Okay, that's great. It's still a mouse. It still lives, you know, 2 years. And if it lives 2.5 years now, that's great. Well, we still live 80 years, you know. So I'm kind of befuddled by that. But all I can do, I guess, is try not to be too obnoxious as I'm yelling.
Yeah. What about bowhead whales? Do we know anything about, like, the hypotheses around why they live so long?
There are some genomic studies of bowhead whales, and there are a few people that have actually cells of bowhead whales in the lab, but it's very early. And I think there's only so much you can learn from the genome. It's certainly a good place to start. And I think now that we're so good at sequencing genomes, it's a perfect place to start with any new organism. But I think you have to dig deeper into the biology. And I think that it's possible now. I mean, we have better tools than ever for trying to understand these non-traditional exotic species. We just need to really bring them to bear in a serious way. I mean, the way that this has typically happened in the past is that, so for instance, I used to study these little pet store parakeets, because they can live up to 20 years as well. So I work on this for a while, and then I run out of funding and I move on to something else and never make a lot of progress, because what you really need is a sustained effort of a lot of people with complementary expertise to really focus attention on species that are more successful in humans. To me, that ought to be the criterion for what makes a species interesting. It's more successful than humans are at X, you know, mm-hmm. X being some mechanism that we think is involved in aging. Not, oh, gee, it ought to be better than a mouse. Well, anything's better than a mouse.
What are some of the other long-lived animals that you wish there were more studies being done on?
Well, I mean, I'm very interested in the studies of the naked mole rat. That's a really interesting animal. I actually think there's tremendous amount probably to learn from other species of birds, because we don't even know that birds all live a long life the same way. I really think that where we're going to learn the most is from these warm-blooded animals like mammals and birds, because, you know, cold-blooded animals live a long time. A lot of them live a very long time, but they do it because you just slow everything down. And slow living is not the kind of long life that I think we want. The other thing, though, that I think is spectacular is about the large animals. So we don't think of being large in itself as advantageous, but it is. It's advantageous in this sense. Assume that every cell in your body has the theoretical capability to turn into a cancer and kill you. Well, mice, of course, are tremendously cancer prone because they have relatively few cells compared to us, and they get cancer in 2 years. We're pretty resistant to cancer because we have, 30,000 times as many cells as a mouse, and we resist it for decades. But think of a bowhead whale. It's got hundreds of times as many cells as we do, yet somehow it manages to live, 100, 200 years without dying of cancer. How does it do that? It's got to have some incredible tricks. We already know that for elephants, right? For elephants, we know they have multiple copies of this P53 gene. And that, unfortunately, that's not something that's very obvious to me, how we would transform that understanding into better preventatives for humans. But it's the kind of thing, that's a very cool discovery. I mean, I have to say, it's very neat.
Yeah. Do we know anything about why bowhead whales die, or what do they die from?
No, we don't know a thing. I mean, they used to mostly die because people killed them. But that's not true any longer. So no, we don't. And let's imagine, though, that they all died of cancer. They would still be remarkably cancer resistant because it takes them a century or two to do that. Now, there has been a little bit of work on their genome looking at some of the tumor suppressor genes that they have and noting that they're different in some ways, but understanding how that different might translate into better prevention or protection against cancer, we just don't know yet. But it's the kind of thing that really deserves, I think, a lot of thought and a lot of study. And like I say, there are tools available today. We could take their skin cells and turn them into liver cells if we wanted to, and maybe learn why they don't get liver cancer so quickly. We could take this the same thing with, I mean, there's lots of possibilities. I'm like a kid in a candy store at this point. I want to grab people by the lapels and say, look, this is where you're wasting your money on those mice. Come here. Look at the birds and the whales. And the bats. We haven't talked about bats yet, but bats are one of my other passions because they're small, they live a long time, an incredibly long time, really. And they have some other features of successful aging that are immediately imaginable for translation to humans. And let me just give you a couple of examples. The insect-eating bats hunt with their high frequency hearing, right? They blast these sounds and listen for the echoes. Well, that's the first thing that goes in humans is their high frequency hearing. By the time you're in your 20s, you've lost a great deal of your high frequency hearing. But bats have maintained that for 30, 40 years. How do they do that? They also fly 50 to 100 miles a night for prey. And then in the dark, they return to where it is and maybe find their pup and a million other bats in a cave somewhere. So they get this incredibly prolonged sense of spatial memory. And then if you and I break an arm and we get a cast in it, or we're bedridden for a few weeks, our muscles that just shrink and we get out of bed and we take the cast off and we're horrified at what's happened to the muscles of our bats. Hibernate for month after month after month after month. And then what happens? They wake up and they fly away. How do they do that? That's, again, that's one of these remarkable things that's out there in nature waiting for us to learn how to turn to human advantage.
Do you think it could be anything to do with their reproductive timelines or cycles? Because for humans, I mean, aging really only starts sort of after reproductive age, right? Because nature wants you to pass on your genes. So is there anything about these animals where their timeline is just longer, it's pushed forward, they need to give more care to their young?
Sure. Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, a mouse-sized bat takes a year to become sexually mature, and a mouse takes a month. So, but what understanding what's behind that, right? That's really what we want to know. And one of my mantras is, you don't have to study old bats necessarily to do this. What you need to do is understand what keeps a young bat from becoming an old bat. And those secrets should be right there, you know, even in young animals. So you just need to figure out what they are. So I think people overestimate how difficult it would be to learn some important lessons from some of these exotic species. Certainly it's not easy, but I don't think it's like starting over from scratch and we don't know anything about aging. I mean, what we have learned from the model species, like the worms and the flies and the mice, is I think we kind of learned where to look. We've looked at the basic process. Well, look at how they maintain their mitochondria. How do they maintain their proteome? We know these are the kind of important things. Now we just need to figure out, well, here's nature. It's figured out how to do it better than we already do it. Well, what is that that nature has figured out?
I think Richard Feynman has a quote, something like this, where like, just look to nature. It has the answers. I'm totally butchering it, but it's something similar.
Yeah, we said a lot of very clever and astute things, and it doesn't surprise me that he wouldn't have said something like that.
Yeah. So can you tell us why animal species that fly live longer than the earthbound ones, and why do animals found in the ocean live the longest?
Yeah, well, there's two ways to answer that, really. It depends on the level of explanation that you're looking for, right? So I think the evolutionary explanation why animals that fly tend to be long-lived is that one of the things that we know about evolution is that animals that evolve in safe environments, environments that they're not likely to get killed by random acts of nature that they can't do anything about, tend to live longer than animals that live in more hazardous environments. In fact, one of the first things I did in aging research is I compared a population of opossums on a mainland to opossums on an island where there were no predators, and found out that they age more slowly on that island, and it only took them 5,000 years to do that. So I think that the advantages of flight are this, that first of all, you can escape from ground-based predators, right? But the other thing is that flying is a real low-cost way to move a very long distance. So if conditions deteriorate where you happen to be, flying 50 or 100 kilometers is not the same as trying to walk, you know, or trot 50 or 200 kilometers. So I think you're in a position to relocate to where conditions are better. And I think you put those things together, the ability to escape predators, the ability to move long distances to better ecological situation, put those things together. And just by virtue of flying, you live in a safer environment.
Mm-hmm. And what about species that live in water? Why do they live longer?
Well, that is a really interesting one, and particularly in the ocean, right? And I think for cold-blooded species, I think it's pretty obvious that you're living where it's really cold. It slows everything down. You know, my favorite story about these long-lived oceanic creatures is the Greenland shark, you know, which indirect evidence suggests can live 300, maybe even 400 years. What we don't, and the Greenland shark, like the bowhead whale, is the coldest water living shark there is. In fact, it's also called the bowhead whale is sometimes called the Greenland whale. So they both live in very, very cold water. The difference is, to the shark living in this cold water, its metabolic rate is really, really low. Greenland shark can live a year on can eat one seal and live a year on it. They swim slower than 80-year-olds walk. So they live a very, very, very slow life. So for ectothermic animals, animals whose metabolism is dictated by, you know, most of the ocean is very cold. It's only the surface level that's heated by the sun. Most of it's, you know, within a few degrees of zero. So I think that explains it. It doesn't explain the longevity of whales, though. The whales are, and it's tempting to say, well, it's a great size. That protects them somewhat. But I mean, you have to be a small whale before you're a large whale. And so this is a mystery I really ought to think about more. I have to admit, I haven't thought as much about the effects of an aquatic environment as I probably should have.
And what's the other explanation? You gave the evolutionary one.
So the other one would be more mechanistic, right? That there's something about the physiological demands of flight, let's say, that require such exquisitely tuned cells and cellular communications that just the nature of those physical demands requires building an exquisite body. A friend of mine has called this the third world taxi versus third world airplane phenomenon, which is, you know, in a lot of places in the third world, you go out and you get a taxi and the bumpers crashed in, the headlights falling out. Doesn't matter. You know, it still gets you around. It gets you where to go. You don't find airplanes like that, because if you fly airplanes like that, you die. So airplanes have to be really, really well maintained to keep flying. And I think there may be something in the physiological refinement, the really exquisite building of something capable of sustained flight that that inadvertently leads to longevity.
Okay. So you've done some work on caloric restriction as well, and this might be another one of the areas where you say that, you know, you point out things that others fail to see, they might know about. You have a paper that's called Beyond Caloric Restriction, and you talk about, you know, maybe there's something else that's happening outside of caloric restriction that's causing some of the longevity effects. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. We used to think that that caloric restriction was simply a matter of how many calories you ate and that eating less was better. Although I have to say, I've never really understood how to translate that from laboratory rodents to humans. You know, does it mean taking obese humans and having them diet to the point that what we consider to be a healthy body weight is where they'll be, or taking people with a healthy body weight and having them eat to the point where they're emaciated, what we would think of as emaciated? And I don't think that there's an obvious answer to that, because most laboratory mice are obese. You know, I'm one of the few people that have actually studied wild mice, and wild mouse has got less than a third of the body fat of a laboratory mouse.
And does it have an effect on them, caloric restriction on wild mice?
Well, I did one study on this and I found an interesting result. So I did this because I wanted to see, is this simply an effect that we've created these laboratory gluttons, which we've really done by the way we've selected mice, right? Commercial entities that sell a lot of mice, well, they want their mice to grow as fast and reproduce as much as possible. And the way that for them to do that is to eat, just eat like crazy, eat way more than is good for your health. All right. So I thought, well, wild mice won't have been selected for that. So what would happen if I brought wild mice in and calorically restricted them? So I did that. And there was, you know, as they were dying off, I had some of the restricted ones died early, and then they kind of became the same. And I was all ready to write up the paper saying there's no effect of caloric restriction on the longevity of wild mice. But the last about 20% of the mice that were alive were all the restricted ones. You know, all the ones that were fully fed were dead now, and I've only got these restricted ones left. And I started thinking, well, what's the difference here? And what I concluded was, in the laboratory, all of our mice are pretty much genetically identical. But in wild mice, they're like people. They're genetically different. And maybe what I've discovered here is that dietary restriction is good for some particular people with certain genes or mice with certain genes. Doesn't have much of an effect on others. And maybe it's bad for other genes. And genetically, that's turned out to be the case, because even now with laboratory mice, we know ones that don't do so well on caloric restriction and ones that do very, very well. But I think we've moved beyond that, because what we always assumed is that it was really the number of calories. And originally we thought, well, it doesn't even matter what the composition of those calories is. So you could restrict protein or fat or carbohydrate. It doesn't really matter. Now it looks like that's probably not true, that it's really the protein restriction that might be the important thing, at least for laboratory mice. But one of the things that I'm kind of horrified that I didn't notice this is that if you do these studies and you go in, the mice, the restricted mice, they're waiting for you. You open the door of the mouse room and they're hanging on their little cage there waiting for you to be fed, and they gobble their food all down incredibly fast. Whereas the ones that are fully fed, they kind of nibble day in and day out. So finally someone thought maybe it's not the amount they're eating, but the timing of their eating. And the fact that the restricted ones are eating all of their food within the first 30 minutes and then fasting for 23 and a half hours, maybe that's just as important as how much they're eating. And it now looks like there's something to that, because we now know there's this fasting physiology. And that fasting physiology turns on all kinds of protective mechanisms in your body. And so now there's a whole new round of research, and a lot of people, of course, doing what's called intermittent fasting, which is really trying to restrict the timing out when you eat. And I mean, all the answers aren't available yet, whether that's really just another way of controlling your calories or whether there's something into the timing. We don't really know all the answers yet, but it's very provocative. And it's very provocative also because people could do that. You know, I can tell you, people cannot calorically restrict like we do. Yeah. See, you know, it's a rare, rare person that can do that. And, but anybody almost, I think, could say, okay, I'm going to do all my eating between 11 in the morning and 6 at night or 8 mm-hmm. at night or something. Almost anybody could do that. And if that is a way of controlling calories, maybe that just prevents obesity, whatever. People can do it. And if it helps people maintain a healthy body weight, that's great. Now, there's one other thing, though, having to do with the timing of eating, and that's the time of day that you do this. I just made that up, you know, 11 in the morning to 7 or 8 at night, because that happens to be well when I eat. But I don't know that that's the best for me. You know, 85% of our genes get turned on and off on these sort of daily rhythms, you know, and it may be that there's a best time of day to eat. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what that is yet because we haven't done the right studies. And it may also be that the best time of day to eat is different for you than it is for me. Those are all things that, I mean, we're just starting to learn about these biological rhythms. It may be that there's a best time of day to do your cancer chemotherapy. Right? That there's a best time of day to take your vitamins or whatever you do. That's really, really intriguing. And again, these are things that people could do, right? If somebody told me, well, if you want to age 20% slower, you have to do all your eating between 6 a.m. and 2 p.m., I could do that. I don't know if I would, but I know I could if I were sufficiently motivated.
I agree with you. The point around circadian rhythms and just when your genes are turned on and off is super intriguing, because it's like, well, if I know, as you said, in the morning it's more effective, then I can just change my hours around a little bit and do less of it at night and like more of my eating in the morning or whatever it is.
Yeah. So I have to tell you a circadian rhythm story from my lion training days. I decided at one point, and this is, remember, I had, you know, I was a poet at this point. I had nothing about biology. I was trying to train lions, but also write movie scripts, because if I can't write the great American novel, maybe I can get rich movie scripts. But I was having a heck of a time finding the time to do both. And I decided, well, I know how I could do it. All I need to do is make the week into 6 days instead of 7 days. So I just thought, well, if I stay up 18 hours and sleep 10, then the week only consists of 6 days. And I never thought of the fact that every day I'd be time shifting myself another 4 hours. Every 3 days, you're completely reversing the time cycle. So I did this for about 3 days, and I got so grumpy And I thought, I'm going to get myself killed by a lion, because I could tell myself in interacting with the lions that I was just irritable. And, you know, there's sometimes you don't want to be irritable with the lion. So I abandoned that. And it was only years afterwards, when I was telling somebody about this, they said, what kind of a moron would even try this? You never heard of circadian rhythms? I said, no, actually, at that time, I never had heard of circadian rhythms.
I mean, it's like a lot of us do this in college too, right? When you're just pulling all-nighters or sleeping for 5 hours. And I remember my college days, I barely slept. And I was so grumpy. And when I graduated, and I guess I had more of a like a normal life, I was sleeping a little more. And I realized, like, wow, what was I doing? I was so irritable so many times. Like it didn't even cross my mind that sleep could be lot more important.
Yeah, no, and that's fine if you're only grumpy with your college friends, but if you're grumpy with a snotty lion, you know, that could be trouble.
That's funny. That's really funny. So there's one thing you mentioned on caloric restriction around, maybe it's the fact that mice are eating all the calories in like the 30 minutes and it's the fasting. Has no one done studies where, you know, you could calorically restrict the mice, but you just give them food at regular intervals, like you give them a breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever. So that way you remove the fasting element, but you're still restricting their calories.
Yeah, I mean, people are doing those kinds of experiments now. And actually, one of the things, you know, I kind of pretending that it never occurred to me before, but it turns out one of the reasons I didn't think much of it was there had been one study that I knew about, and it was a rat study. And what they had done is they tested this idea by breaking the daily food into two parts and feeding it in two smaller parts. It had no effect at all. But in retrospect, it was a cursory study. It was done only in males. It was done in only one kind of rat. And, you know, my thought now is, first of all, studying only males is crazy because we now know that there's so many sex differences in aging. But again, it may have been that just breaking it up into two equal size sections was not the right way to destroy the fasting aspect of it.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, we'll know more about this, but I mean, again, it's mice and they're, you know, they're nocturnal animals, and most of what we do with them is we do it in the daytime. So even on a mouse's own terms, I think that we have a lot to think about the way we do our experiments.
So, and there's one other point you mentioned was that, you know, you're really not sure whether any of this even translates to humans. And so much of it is, okay, sure, if you calorically restrict obese people, yes, that can have a benefit, but that's also just because they're losing weight.
Right.
And do we know anything much about, because I believe that was one, the calorie study, right? Do we know anything about like what effect it has on healthy humans eating, also eating healthy diets? Because I think there are two parts of it. It's like, well, they probably go hand in hand, but it's also like, could I be calorically restricting and just eating pizza all day? Like, does that even count? Does that make me live longer? Or
yeah, well, I mean, sure. I mean, we know healthy diets can promote or prevent early heart attacks, right? And I mean, the calorie studies were interesting, but it depends on how you squint at them. You know, what you think you can learn from them. First of all, the people were a little bit overweight, as we call overweight to start off. And when they lost it, they didn't get to be, you know, BMI of 19 like people in the caloric restriction society. They got to be healthy body weight like many people are. It had certain health benefits, certainly, but it's not too surprising to me that it had health benefits, because you're taking people that were slightly overweight, making, and probably they're paying more attention to their health because they're in this study. Actually, one of the meetings that we had after the calorie study was over, we were joking that maybe we could have done this by paying each participant $250,000 to lose weight for 2 years.
I think that would work well on a lot of humans.
That would be a good motivator, I would say.
Okay. So we don't really have much data on whether it that has any benefit on healthy humans.
I would say no. I would, and I you know, I mean the yeah, if you're a healthy body weight human and you're active, would then eating 20% less, you know, I mean, one of the things that the calorie study demonstrated without question is that people as a whole can't do this. You know, they were trying to restrict 25%, and what they ended up about 11% or something like that. Because it's like a fellow that I ran into years ago, and he told me he was doing caloric restriction, or he said he'd done it for a few years. And I said, well, that's interesting. I said, I used to calorically restrict myself in college. Well, I was a college wrestler and I was always trying to cut weight, but I was grumpy all the time. I said, were you grumpy? He goes, no, I wasn't grumpy. I cheated so much on my diet that I never felt really hungry.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, that's another point about just diet composition versus calories too.
So yeah, I mean, I think we have a lot to learn about this, but I do think that there's precious little evidence that if you're a healthy body weight and you're doing what we, the general public, knows to be living a healthy lifestyle, that restricting your calories is going to do much for you. Maybe, but I'm dubious about that.
Okay. So you had another book published in April. It's called To Err is Human, To Admit It Is Not. And there were a couple of chapters, chapter titles that stood out to me, and I was hoping you could talk a bit about it.
Sure.
So the first one I have is Will Coffee Shorten Your Life?
Yes. So the reason that I wrote that chapter was I was trying to educate people on about the way science is done, right? And one of the things about the way science is done is that science done in humans is very, very weak. And it's weak for exactly the reason that the calorie study was so difficult, is that people don't necessarily do it. And so almost all the coffee studies are what I call observational. That is, you take people, you ask them how much coffee they drink, and you try to correlate that with certain lifestyle effects. And when you do that, you can't rely on the results for several reasons. First of all, you don't necessarily believe people. You know, they may tell you the truth. They may tell you what they think is the truth, and it may or may not be the truth. There may be all kinds of things that they're doing in the rest of their life that you didn't measure. And the point I wanted to make is that the only way you can believe studies like this is if the effect is huge. So, you know, these kinds of studies in smoking always show this enormous difference, you know, 10-year difference in longevity. There was a study from the 1930s that showed that. If you look at all the coffee studies, they're little bitty effects, you know, and sometimes they're positive and sometimes they're negative. And so what this means to me is the effects are small, whether ultimately they're positive or negative, they're small. And so no, probably coffee doesn't shorten your life. Maybe it will lengthen it a little. Maybe it will just make it seem a little bit shorter. I don't know. But the whole idea with that chapter is let's understand what we would need to do to really know that. We'd have to take a whole bunch of people, randomly assign some of them to drink coffee, some of, and of course, then there's, well, what kind of coffee? How much coffee? I mean, it's complicated, right? So this is why people study mice, because humans are so difficult.
And the other point you made about genetic differences too, I'm sure different people react differently, different kinds of food when they're eating. There are just so many complications with nutrition studies, I feel like.
Exactly. It's, you know, I one time listened to at an aging meeting, a very expensive, well done human nutrition study. And at the end of it, the conclusion was that people that ate a lot of hamburgers and French fries were not as healthy as people that ate a lot of fruits and vegetables.
That's funny. It's like it's how it goes back to just listen to what your parents or your grandma told you to do, right? It comes
Exactly.
down to that.
Yeah, I'm delighted that you looked into this other book that I wrote, because that one was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I love the way you've written it with just different essays. So it would be, yeah, it's definitely nice to talk about it. So the second one I have on my list is the Blue Zone myth.
Yeah. So there are these things that Dan Buettner coined the term, I think, blue zones, which are places where people live exceptionally long and healthy lives. And the reason that I called it the blue zone myth is for most of those blue zones, we don't really know that people live exceptionally long, healthy lives. Now, some of them, the Loma Linda, religious sects, those people, they don't live 130 years, but they certainly, their life expectancy is in the mid 80s and they do live healthy. But a lot of these places, there's this theme in aging research that people want to find these places with these magical longevities. And some of those, I think, crept into the blue zone myth. So one in particular, so when I first read about this, one of them is in Sardinia, one of them is on a Greek island, one of them is on this peninsula, Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica. Well, I had just come from Costa Rica. And when I read, and I go, I don't know, I saw a lot of people, a lot of centenarians. What was a record keeping like in Costa Rica 100 years ago? I'm really going to rely on this, because people had been foxed in the past by these things in Ecuador and in the Karakoram Mountains. And so I actually went to the UN Demographic Data Book, which is a data book that countries will send their demographic information to them. And I said, I'm going to see what it says about Costa Rica, because there's certain ways you can tell when people are fudging the data. One of the ways is that there's a lot more 100-year-olds than there are 101 or 102-year-olds or 98 or 99-year-olds. So I was looking at the life expectancies of older people. Now, in the U.S. and in most of developed countries, if you get to be 100 years old, your life expectancy is about 2 or 2.5 years. And that doesn't change that much from your late 90s. So I'm looking at Costa Rica and going, okay, 98, it's 2.5 years. 99, it's 2.4 years. 100, it's 12.5 years. And then 101, it's 2 years again. And I said, okay, this is age-keeping. Everybody knows this is nonsense. And that's what I would expect. And I actually even wrote a letter to the minister of some department in Costa Rica saying, what is this? So that's why I call it the blue zone myth, because I think for most of the places, we don't have sufficient information. I mean, most of them, now not the Loma Linda, crowd, but most of them is people that live in these rural areas with, hard work, tight social networks, no reliable birth records whatsoever. I think that's the key thing for a lot of these. Now, Sardinia might be an example because professional demographers have gone and looked into there's two things about Sardinia that's weird. It tends to be the men there that usually that's a good way to tell that it's bogus, is if all the supposed long live people are men, because we know that's simply not the case. Sardinia seems to be an exception. It's not even the whole island. It's just a couple of villages there. But everywhere else in the world, if somebody tells you, oh yeah, there's all the old people are sitting, all those guys sitting on the bench over there, that's bogus, because it's the women that live the longest, and it's pretty much everywhere.
So you think it's just some, I guess people just had bad data and then stories got constructed?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very famous case from the 1970s where National Geographic paid this Harvard professor, a physician named Alexander Leaf, to go examine three areas of the world that had this reported extreme longevity. One was in Ecuador, one was in Russia, what's Azerbaijan now, one was in what's Pakistan, Afghanistan now. And he came back with these glowing reports on how long people lived. But then what tipped him off that he might have been Fox is the oldest guy in this valley of Vilcabamba in Ecuador is 126 years old, supposedly. Leaf went back 18 months after that met the guy again. He was 131 months old or 131 years old. So he said, aha, maybe somebody's not telling me. I mean, he may well have believed it, but, you know, not everybody has a great memory at the age of 126. So then a couple of professional anthropologists went down and examined the church records. And it turned out that they had this habit in that valley of if somebody died, they would name the next child with exactly the same name. So when Leif had gone and examined all the church birth records, he'd been really misled. It turned out all the people that were supposedly over 100 years old had an average age of 78. You know, and in Russia was similarly debunked. The people that were supposed to be 160, well, they were using their grandparents' birth certificates. And so you get to be quite cynical about these reports, particularly if they're in areas, very remote areas that, you know, 100 years ago, really you couldn't expect them to have good birth records.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the third one is young blood, I can't get you out of my mind.
Oh yeah, well this was about the findings that transfusions of young blood into old mice rejuvenates them in a really remarkable way. And I think this is actually one of the more interesting developments in aging biology, is that this has been repeated in a number of laboratories. And I think it's something very real there. Now, what we don't know is, first of all, what is behind that? Is there some magic potion in young blood that's rejuvenating? Or equal possibility, is there something really toxic in old blood? And by doing this, are you diluting that out? But I think this is one of the things that I could see translating. If that's the case, and we know now that, you know, old mitochondria break apart and mitochondrial DNA ends up in your blood and it circulates. I mean, there's lots of bad things that probably are in old blood. If we can figure this out, I think there's some real possibility. And what I've been telling the students that I teach is, hey, you guys are sitting on a gold mine here. You know, a gold mine is flowing through your veins here, potentially, because now you can go out and, of course, purchase the blood from 29-year-olds and get transfusions. Now, we don't know if this works yet in people, but it seems to me quite plausible that there are changes. You know, your blood circulates through all your organs and it picks up waste and all. It's quite conceivable to me that there's something to this. And, you know, if I were betting the farm on the first thing that would have a significant effect on human health, I would probably place this pretty close to the top of the list.
Yeah, I had Irina and Michael Conboy on the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
They're doing some excellent work on this. And
yeah,
and
they are.
What they told me that it's mostly the effects of dilution of the old blood.
Right.
Because they tried some of experiments where you're not giving young blood per se, but you're just diluting the old blood. And it gets rid of some of the negative factors like TGF-beta or like some of the other ones that turn negative, and it just rejuvenates several different organs in the mice.
I'm a big fan of hers because everybody else was focusing on the young blood. What is it in the young blood? Somebody had to think, well, wait a second, what it might be about the old blood. And you're right, those are very clever experiments that she did. And so I think there's something real here that we're ultimately going to take advantage of.
I think so too. Yeah, I'm definitely very excited about it. I remember, I mean, the last time I spoke to them, which was earlier this year, they mentioned that there were some studies being done on human. I don't think there were clinical controlled studies, but just sort of experiments that were being done. So if we have more data from that comes through, I think that could be very intriguing.
Yeah, I agree. And it's unfortunate that there aren't well-controlled human studies going on. But again, it's really hard to get permission to give healthy people anything, right?
Yeah.
So what you'd really have to rely on is people that were really sick being willing to be a part of an experiment that may or may not help them
No, I totally agree. There's, I think, one group in Russia, if I remember correctly. They're one of the more progressive, forward thinkers, and I think that some of them were just trying these experiments on themselves and noticing good results.
Yeah, well, but I mean, there's a placebo effect, so you have to be a little bit careful about that. Brown Sicard felt that injecting himself with macerated dog testicles were helping him. So,
Yeah, no, definitely do not recommend people trying it by
but I'm glad you
themselves.
brought that up, because I think that that's exactly the kind of out of the box thinking that we need.
Okay. So the last one I have is hormones and health.
Yes. Well, this is about the growth hormone phenomenon, and I know when I go to the gym and I look around, I can see there are lots of people that are unnaturally muscular. And so there's this controversy. It's quite clear in mice that the best way to make mice live longer is to deactivate growth hormone. No matter how you do it, it makes mice live long. It's not so clear that that's the case in people. And it's not so clear that it's not good for some organs, but bad for other organs or something. So what I've thought is that we really need some human studies. And in fact, I try to recruit people from my local gym, but none of them would cop out to getting growth hormone. And some of them were probably doing anabolic steroids. But the relationship between growth hormone and aging is really pretty interesting, because there's about a half dozen studies of natural mutations where some aspect of growth hormone, and not a single one of them did the people live longer. And some of them, there seemed to be no difference in their longevity, but they didn't die of cancer so often. They died of, suicide more often or something. But wouldn't it be weird, but it's probably just biology, if reducing your growth hormone activity was really, really good for your cancer prevention, but really, really bad for your muscles or your brain or your heart? That's the kind of balance that we're looking at. So hormones and health were all about the fad, really, that's been with us for over 100 years, that all you have to do is take some hormone that you find declining and top it up, and everything will be fine. And I mean, the other alternative is that, well, your body is producing less and less hormone for a good reason, and if you mess with that, you might be doing something bad. So that was what that chapter was about. I have to say, I'm just struck by the, there was this guy, John R. Brinkley, that in the 30s became fabulously wealthy by basically transplanting goat testicles into men and goat ovaries into women. And I mean, in the Depression, this guy had a yacht with a crew of 23, and he had a, I mean, he was just fabulously well. Now, how you could convince people to do that, I mean, I have just think about that. Hey, all you need to do is, I need to implant some goat testicles in you. Oh yeah, of course, sure, go ahead. Where do we start? But that's the kind of gullibility. I mean, it's almost touching that humans are so desperate to stay young longer that they would let somebody, it turns out this guy didn't have really any surgical training. He had bought a medical degree through the mail, and he probably killed dozens and dozens of people in this surgery. We have no idea. Imagine people undergoing that because they wanted to stay young longer. It's just crazy.
That is crazy. Wow. And correct me if I'm wrong, but on the growth hormone side, you said that, well, I guess lower growth hormone helps protect against cancer, but it's bad for muscles, especially as you age and your brain.
I mean, if you start taking exogenous growth hormone, when you get it will be good for your muscles. I was giving a talk once, a public talk, and I was talking about this, and somebody came up to me afterwards, an older gentleman, and said, "Feel my arm." You know, he wanted me to feel his feel my muscle. I go, "Well, I'm really not." He goes, "No, no, feel it." Grabs my hand. He growth hormone did that for me. I go, "Okay, I'm glad it did." So yeah, we know there are certain that you know, I mean, athletes do this all the time, right? They bulk up with growth hormone. It's good for that, but we don't know what it does for the heart and the brain and the, you know, and cancer. You know, if you have dormant cancers, you don't want to have growth hormone. So it's a complicated field.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think one of the last questions I have for you, you've done some work on sex differences in longevity. And I think a recent paper of yours talking about, I guess, the brain and the gonad. What do we know about sex differences in longevity?
Well, first of all, we know they're dramatic. You know, it's not just that women live longer than men, but they die at lower rates from birth to death. So even 2-year-old girls are better survivors than 2-year-old boys. We don't understand this at all. You wouldn't think it would have anything to do with estrogen or testosterone in 2-year-olds. So women die at lower rates of all the major diseases, with the exception of Alzheimer's disease, where women are more prone to Alzheimer's disease, again, for reasons that we don't understand. So everybody knows that. Well, not everybody knows it, but we all know that women live longer than men, right? But it's true when times are bad. It's true when times are good. It's true when there's a pandemic. It's true when there's a famine. What really got my interest is the first half dozen drugs that we discovered that make mice live longer, 5 out of 6 only worked in males. They don't have any effect in females. So I thought, there's some key thing that we're missing here. Probably part of it has to do with hormones. But I think there's more to it than that. And I don't think we understand that at all yet. And the other part of that is that later in life, women are surviving longer, but in worse health on average, more likely to spend more time in the doctor, more likely to have surgery, more often going to end up in nursing homes. So if we could do something as simple as make men live as long as women and keep women healthy as long as men, we would go a great ways towards really having a major impact on human health. Mm-hmm. But we're not there yet. We don't really know.
Yeah.
And again, most of the studies that are looking at this are in mice.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that we haven't covered, I haven't asked you about? You want to?
No, I think you now know everything I know about everything. So
I wouldn't go so as far as that for sure. Okay. Well, fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
This was it's been a lot of fun talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.